And we have looked at the first three of those trumpets. And it's a time of judgment. We have seen that there was in heaven a 30 minutes of silence there in verse 1. And a different angel who had this golden censer came, and he's taking the coals from that censer and he's throwing them to the earth. And we spent a good bit of time last week talking about the fact that the coals of the altar were coals that had kept burning from the time that God first accepted a sacrifice in the tabernacle and then also in Solomon's temple. And so very oddly, we have, what do we have going on here? On the thing there, Tim? Oh, okay. Well, it's also intentionally distracting. I don't have he's going to put up the next slide in just a few minutes, so don't worry about the black screen there. It was so weird to see that. I thought somebody has hacked into my thing, and who knows what's going to come up there. So the third angel that we had talks about this great star falling named Wormwood. We spent some very interesting quotes from Josephus, his wars, and talked about Lucifer. And of course, Lucifer is not a person. It's a star. It's a morning star. That's what it means. And I believe that Wormwood is Josephus himself. He was the Benedict Arnold of their time, and was a turncoat towards the Romans and ends up with the Romans. So that brings us now down to the fourth angel, and that's in verses 12 and 13. The fourth angel sounded his trumpet, and a third of the sun was struck, a third of the moon, and a third of the stars. So that a third of them turned black. A third of the day was without light, and also a third of the night. As I watched, I heard an eagle that was flying in midair call out in a loud voice, "Woe, woe, woe to the inhabitants of the earth, because of the trumpet blast about to be sounded by the other three angels." And again, I'll just point out as we're going through here in verse 13, it says, "Woe, woe to the inhabitants of the earth." You can just put in the word land there, because it's talking about the people of God, and it's the land of the people of God. So again, as we've been going through this, we've been showing parallels between what's going on there and what happened in Egypt. And of course, we have the ninth plague, which was the darkness in Egypt when God was bringing them out. And of course, darkness is going to stand for national calamity. And you think of during this particular period of time in history, all of the rulers, all of the governors of the Jews and of Rome who died. And they died not naturally, but in disgrace. Many of them were assassinated. Even among the religious rulers, as you read through the history of this time, and especially as Josephus is pointing them out, and all of them are quenched suns, moons, and stars that have turned dark. And so these are dark days for God's people and for the people in general. And following the Galilean campaign, when Titus came down, a third of the nation has fallen. So a third of the light of the nation of Israel as it stood there was dimmed. And so now at the end of the fourth trumpet, there's a break of sorts. It's not as big as we're going to see between the sixth and seventh trumpet. But we have an eagle or an angel, and it's probably a cherubim. One of the heads of the cherubim had the head or face of an eagle. And he's flying through the air crying, "Woe, woe, woe." And that is a declaration, a statement of a state of misery, a state of extreme sorrow. It's a message of doom. It's a message of terror. And we already had four evidences of that kind of terror and death and tragedy going on. And he's saying that there's three more that remain. And each of these woes represents one of the three remaining trumpets. Yes, Ross.
I don't really have a cohesive point to this, but one thing I just will remember, I think, forever is when Dr. Vicky was here and he gave the gospel through the numbers gospel meeting. when Jesus does the woes on the Pharisees, like that word he focused on a lot, and he said like great tragedy.
Right.
He describes the Pharisees, like that's how he translated
right.
it. Anyway, I was just looking, Jesus used it a lot, like that specific word.
Yeah, and Ross was just saying, you remembered when Thaxter Dickey was here and he did a whole thing on that, and when he said the word woe, he went through when Jesus was giving the woes, he said
great tragedy.
And if you want to know that it's 180 degrees from blessed. So you have the Beatitudes and you have the woes, and they are at the extremes of both of those there. And interestingly enough, we have one woe for each remaining trumpet. There's also a break historically here in the timeline as we're going through this, because Nero is going to die in June of 68 AD. And that is just following the Galilean campaign. And so there, when a Caesar dies, then if there's no clear successor, like the son of Nero, then everybody's gunning for the spot. And generally it's going to be in a situation like this, it's going to be the most powerful general, because he's got control of the armies. So he has the power to do that. And so Vespasian, who is that, went to Caesarea to await orders from the new government. And as the political situation in Rome worsened and there was no emerging emperor, he was encouraged, no doubt by his own armies, to go back to Rome and to claim the throne for himself, which is exactly what he did. So as you're looking at the order of Caesars, you'll go from Nero to Vespasian. So Rome disappeared for a time. There was they were in confusion and chaos themselves, and so there have been four. There will be three more, and so the rest of these judgments are coming. Now let's go to slide 23. And I probably need to do my own. Well, maybe not. Is that coming up on the screen here too? It will, I'm sure. So I'll stop doing it. You go back to slide 23. There we go. All right, thank you. So let's read verses 1 through 12 of chapter 9, which is the fifth trumpet. The fifth angel sounded the trumpet, and I saw a star that had fallen from the sky to the earth. The star was given the key to the shaft of the abyss. When he opened the abyss, smoke arose from it like the smoke from a gigantic furnace. The sun and sky were darkened by the smoke from the abyss, and out of the smoke, locusts came down upon the earth and were given power like that of scorpions of the earth. They were told not to harm the grass of the earth or any plant or tree, but only those people who did not have the seal of God on their foreheads. They were not given power to kill them, but only to torture them for 5 months. And the agony they suffered was like that of the sting of a scorpion when it strikes a man. During those days, men will seek death, but will not find it. They will long to die, but death will elude them. The locusts looked like horses prepared for battle. On their heads, they wore something like crowns of gold, and their faces resembled human faces. Their hair was like women's hair, and their teeth were like lion's teeth. They had breastplates like breastplates of iron, and the sound of their wings was like the thundering of many horses and chariots rushing into battle. They had tails and stings like scorpions, and in their tails they had the power to torment people for 5 months. They had as king over them the angel of the abyss, whose name in Hebrew is Abaddon and in Greek Apollyon. The first woe is past. Two other woes are to come. So again, the fifth angel sounds. John has seen or sees a star that has already actually fallen, and he's been given the key to the abyss. And when he opened it, it says that smoke like a furnace came out, and then the locusts that tormented men for 5 months. And in the NIV here, I saw a star is what it has in my text. But it's actually, what do some of your other translations have?
Star,
it does have star? Okay. And remember, we talked about last week that a star is a person of power, a dignitary of some sort. And in this case, it's going to be Satan is the star here. Back in chapter 8 and verse 10, you'll see a third angel sounded his trumpet and a great star blazing like a torch fell from the sky. And that's that star in chapter 8 and verse 10. I got to move this fan because it's, as much as I love it, it's turning my page for me. And I don't mean it turned that often. And I'll give you a couple of other passages here, and I think that I've got those. I thought that I would have those up there. Do I have the next slide, Tim? Does it have? No, so don't do that. So let's go over, let's just all open our Bibles to Luke 12. This is when Jesus had sent out the apostles on the limited commission. And in Luke 12 and verse 4, make sure that I've got this correctly. Well, no, Luke 10:18 is what I want. I was going to go back to Revelation. But Luke 10:18 said, I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven. And so that's basically what Jesus is seeing ahead of time there and seeing what happened when he gave the apostles the ability to cast out demons. But going back to Revelation is actually where I was looking for chapter 12. In Revelation chapter 12 and verse 4, it says that his tail swept a third of the stars of the sky and flung them to the earth. The dragon stood in front of the woman. There, go down to verse 9. The great dragon was hurled down, that ancient serpent called the devil or Satan. Also in verse 12 of Revelation 12, therefore rejoice, you heavens, and you who dwell in them, but woe to the earth and the sea, because the devil has gone down to you. He is filled with fury because he knows that his time is short. And so this star that has fallen that we're reading about right now is in my opinion, Satan. And this is his time of wrath. Not the time of his falling, which happened long before. That's at this point in time, yes.
So now I'm thoroughly confused, because I thought that you look at verses where it was mistranslated Lucifer because of the Latin word that was for star,
right,
that was similar to Lucifer. But now you're saying that this star does perhaps represent Satan. So what am I missing? Where did the name Lucifer come from?
Lucifer is a Latin word that means light, a star. A misapplication of Isaiah.
Oh.
Yeah, that if you look in Isaiah, you'll find that's the king of Babylon that they're talking about, not talking about Satan. And if you, when I'm done with this class tomorrow, I'll be loading my notes up from last week, from that chapter, and you can see, or you can listen to the class again, because I know you were busy back there that last week doing other things. So, it's. Lucifer was a misapplication in the Latin. It just means morning star. And the King James Version capitalized it and made it into a person with a person's name.
May I ask a question?
Yes.
So my question is, you're saying that Satan is the star, but
in this case,
a star mean light? Because like, you know, like in the children's nursery rhymes and stuff, we wish upon a star.
No, it's not. This is a signet, a sign. This is symbolic. And so this star is standing for a dignitary, as we've seen already other stars. And in fact, in this text, we have a third of the stars, which were a lot of the government people, and both the Jews and the Romans were killed and assassinated during this time. And so, but this is talking about, in this particular case, a great star that had fallen. And in fact, we find out at the very end of this that angel is Abaddon or Apollyon, which are just other names for Satan. The only reason we know that this star is a person or a personage is because we're told that. And so it's just, it's remember, this is not literal. We're looking at signs and symbols here, and this sign is a star is used of a government person, a person who is has power, and so this person that's being tossed down here, we're going to find out, and we find out in the 12th chapter as well, that this is Satan.
Okay, appreciate it. So not all stars are Satan.
Oh, no.
Correct?
No.
Okay.
Most, just all stars in reality are stars. I mean, they're just physical things. Okay. Yeah, remember that this is just, it's like what we're going to see here now. We're not talking about real locusts. These are symbols of things. The abyss that he has been given here is the place of demons. Remember in Luke, the 8th chapter, when Legion, you know, was in the demoniac, and please don't throw me back into the abyss, you know, let me go into this herd of swine. And so the abyss is the place of demons. And so what we're seeing in this picture here is the influence of Satan in this war of the Romans and the Jews, and what's going to happen there. Locusts, listen, if you lived in this particular day and time and you were an agrarian society, what did locusts represent? Death and destruction. I mean, it's going to take away everything that you had here. And these people were in that society familiar with locusts, and they feared them. But again, well, you see the same figure in the minor prophet of Joel. You see the locusts just coming in, and they are not, again, real locusts. Oddly enough, we know that these are not real locusts. And in fact, I think the Aldridges and I were talking about this last week. If you read Late Great Planet Earth by Hal Lindsey, he's saying these are helicopters. And their stingers, you know, are the missiles in their tails. And I think in the first class that we had in this book, we stated, if I'm going to understand what Revelation is saying, I have to understand it like they understood it. And I'm pretty sure that there wasn't any first century Jews that had a concept of a helicopter or missiles in their repertoire of knowledge. And so basically they represent destructive forces of death and destruction of Satan. And we even know more about that, because why do locusts eat? Anything that's green. And these are commanded to not eat anything that's green. Don't harm the grass or the earth or plants or any. Don't do what you would naturally do if you were a locust. And so, the main message is that if you're telling locusts not to eat what they would normally naturally eat, then who's in control? God is in control. Because he's controlling even what they're doing there. And the green things in this particular situation then become the righteous. The people who actually were sealed, that we saw earlier, that received the seal of God. They have been sealed, and that's why, and no one can hurt them. And let's go back here and read this. The only people that they could hurt were those who did not have the seal of God on their foreheads. Now, why could no one hurt them? Well, because, again, keep your finger there. Go back to Luke 21. And the only reason I didn't put this on the screen is because we looked at this last week. In Luke chapter 21 and verses 20 through 22, Jesus said, "When you see Jerusalem being surrounded by armies, you will know its desolation is near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, let those in the city get out, and let those in the country not enter the city, for this is the time of punishment and fulfillment of all that has been written." Listen, the only people that are going to be listening to what Jesus said there are his followers, his faithful followers. So when they saw Jerusalem surrounded, they left. That's why they're not going to be harmed. They're not there. They're already gone. All right, let's look at slide 24. Tim, this is from the wars. But now Cestus, this is the general there, observing that the disturbance that were begun among the Jews afforded him a proper opportunity to attack them, took his whole army along with him and put the Jews to flight and pursued them to Jerusalem. And now it was that a horrible fear seized upon the seditious, insomuch that many of them ran out of the city as though it were to be taken immediately. But the people upon this took courage, and where the wicked part of the city gave ground, thither did they come, in order to set open the gates and to admit Cestius as their benefactor. So some Jews were wanting to let him in and save them. Next slide. Speaking of Cestius, had he but continued the siege a little longer, had certainly taken the city. But it was, I suppose, owing to the aversion God had already at the city and the sanctuary that he was hindered from putting an end to the war that very day. It then happened that Cestius was not conscious either how the besieged despaired of success, nor how courageous the people were for him. And so he recalled his soldiers from the place, and by despairing of any expectation of taking it without having received any disgrace, he retired from the city without any reason in the world. And so here's the Roman general who got Jerusalem surrounded, and then he just pulled back. And according to Josephus, he had no reason at all to do that. Now, I read this week that there was such murder and mayhem going on inside of Jerusalem that he, in mercy, was pulling back so that the people inside the city wouldn't have this great civil war. At least that was in his mind. But what happened was that this is exactly what Jesus said. When you see Jerusalem surrounded, get out. They had the opportunity to get out, and they did. So there was no reason, according to Josephus, except the providence of God and his promise. Yes?
So I'm looking at the sheet, and one of the questions is talking about the significance and the breaking between the fourth and fifth trumpets. But I was reading through the verses, and I can't really see where the break is. Is that where the eagle is flying and crying out, woe, woe? Is that the break?
Yeah, well, that's the break between the fourth and fifth, but it's just a tiny break. Yes, and the significance, Megan is asking what the significance of that question was, is that this is the significance, that there's this break in between, and this is when the people were able to get out. And it's going to get worse, but they were able to escape. And so by that time, by the time the fifth trumpet sounded, all of the Christians were gone. So 5 months is the period, and 5 months not to kill but to torment, which is, ironically enough or wisely enough, that's the lifespan of a locust. They usually live between May to September. This is not the Romans, because the purpose of the Romans coming was to kill and to destroy. So what you have here is probably the seditious Jews within the city. They're the ones who are tormenting. They're the ones who are in this civil war. And let's go to slide 26, because this speaks of Simon, who was the leader of one of the seditious bands inside of Jerusalem. Now, besides this want of provisions that he was in, he was of a barbarous disposition and bore great anger at this nation, by which means it came to pass that Idumea was greatly depopulated. And as one may see all the woods behind despoiled of their leaves by locusts after they had been there, so there was nothing left behind Simon's army but a desert. Now, Simon is not a Roman. Simon is a Jew. And so he has, according to Josephus, done exactly what we just would expect locusts to do. In fact, he even uses that simile there. So they are apostate Jews. They are servants of Satan. And listen, this is one of many examples of the atrocities that took place in the civil war among the Jews between themselves. And especially as the Romans pulled back a little bit there, they took that, the Jews did, as a sign from God that he was with them and that they were going to be able to overcome the Romans. And so they take off after them. And of course, they're just going to be completely annihilated as a result of that. So you have this siege of the Jews that's going to last for 3.5 years, or 42 months, or 1,260 days, which is a question that you'll get in your lessons. And we have three major factions here. We have the Romans on the outside, and then we have two fighting Jewish factions warring against each other on the inside. And it's a pretty terrifying description of the locusts. As you look at how they're described here, they look like horses. Their heads, they wore crowns. Their faces resembled humans. Their hair was like a woman. Their teeth were like lion's teeth. I mean, you can't you can't get a more terrifying picture of what this is. And it's, again, symbolic of the great fear. And it's the intended design of that description is to show the fear that they were bringing into the people. Now, again, listen to Josephus in the Book of Wars, Volume 4, Chapter 9, Verse 10. And this is 27 through, slides 27 through 29. They also devoured... Yep, you went too far on mine, on the one on the screen. They also devoured what spoils they'd taken together with their blood and indulged themselves, this is the men now, in feminine wantonness without any disturbance, till they were satiated therewith. While they decked their hair and put on women's garments and were besmeared over with ointments, that they might appear very comely, they had paints under their eyes and imitated not only the ornaments but also the lusts of women, and were guilty of such intolerable uncleanness that they invented unlawful pleasures of the sort. Next slide. And thus did they also roll themselves up and down the city as in a brothel house and defiled it entirely with their impure actions. Nay, while their faces looked like the faces of women, they killed with their right hands. And when their gait was effeminate, they presently attacked the men and became warriors, and drew their swords from under their finely dyed cloaks and ran everybody through whom they alighted on. Next slide. However, Simon wanted for such as ran away from John, who's the other leader of the other faction, and was more bloody of the two, and he who had escaped the tyrant within the wall was destroyed by the other that lay before the gate, so that all attempts of flying and deserting to the Romans were cut off as to those who had a mind so to do. So there was a little window in there when the Christians could escape, and then after that it was over. After that it was over. And remember again, the locust signifies something, and it's perhaps something like we just read here. And who is behind all of this? Well, in verse 11, the king over them is the angel of the abyss, who's in Hebrew is Abaddon, and who in Greek is Apollyon, and it's the destroyer, and that's Satan. And again, the reason we know that, because we're actually told there. It's easy to know what the sign is when it's identified for us. Okay, so that's one of the three woes that are past. There's two more that remain. And so the next angel, the sixth angel, is going to sound his trumpet here in verses 13 down through verse 21. It says, the sixth angel sounded his trumpet, and I heard a voice coming from the horns of the altar that is before God, and said to the sixth angel who had the trumpet, release the four angels who are bound at the great river Euphrates. And the four angels who had been kept ready for that very hour and day and month and year were released to kill a third of mankind. The number of the mounted troops were 200 million. I heard their number. Now that's what the NIV says. You probably have myriads of myriads there, and I'll explain that in just a minute. The horses and riders I saw in my vision looked like this. Their breastplates were fiery red, dark blue, and yellow as sulfur. The heads of the horses resembled the heads of lions, and out of their mouth came fire, smoke, and sulfur. A third of mankind was killed by the three plagues of fire, smoke, and sulfur that came out of the mouths. The power of the horses was in their mouths and in their tails, for their tails were like snakes, having heads with which they inflict injury. The rest of mankind that were not killed by these plagues still did not repent of the work of their hands. They did not stop worshiping demons and idols of gold, silver, and bronze, stone, and wood, idols that cannot see or hear or walk. Nor did they repent of their murders, their magic arts, their sexual immorality, or their thefts. So, verse 12 is one woe is past, two are remaining, and then we see the trumpet. And you can see that this one is more intense than the previous one. The release of the four angels at the Euphrates River and their destruction, their armies and plagues. And you hear a voice from the altar. This, I believe, is the same altar as we read in chapter 6 and verse 9, which got the souls of the slain saints under it. And the same altar from which in chapter 8 and verse 3, the angel took his censer and cast the coals to the earth. And the voice here that's being heard is the result of the prayers of these saints and their sacrifice. Listen, the Euphrates River was the natural border between the Roman Empire and the Parthian Empire. And so Rome kept troops there on the border to keep the Parthians at bay. They were just stationed there constantly and permanently almost, because the Romans were never able to defeat the Parthians, and so they were guarding that border. This is a call that's going to release those Roman armies for other duty. Listen, the Roman army was raised up by God, among others, for the purpose of punishing his people, his disobedient people, and to help with the ratification and, in fact, the spread of the gospel and of the new covenant. And again, all without Rome's permission. I mean, God didn't sign a contract with them for them to do that. And for all of this history, this moment in history in verse 15, for this very hour and day and month and year, it's that point in time that Vespasian took the throne in Rome. And Titus's son was given command, and these armies that were at the Parthian border were released from there and told to go to Jerusalem. So Titus, he has countless thousands. I think most of your translations have two myriads of myriads, and you could just write that out as countless thousands. Two myriads would be 20,000 times myriad, which is 10,000, which comes to 200 million, if you do the math correctly, and that which is like the army of the Lord. And the population, listen, the whole population of the world is estimated to be about that at this time. So it's not that many soldiers. It's, again, a symbol that the whole world is involved in this. It's a symbolic judgment that the whole world is against God's people in Israel, and that she is going to cease to exist as a nation of as God's people. Now, while the number reminds us of God, the horses remind us of Satan. There's fire and smoke and brimstone. They're going to kill one-third of all of mankind. In fact, Josephus, in his history, estimates that 1.1 million Jews died during this civil war. And that's not counting those that died in the tribulation prior to the 3.5 years of civil war here. So this advancing army destroyed everything in its wake. They carried with them engines of destruction, catapults that would throw huge spears and stones. And you can see, and so while all of that is very interesting, I want you to notice specifically here, verse 20, the heart of the people, former people of God, how they accepted this extreme discipline from God. You have the zealots. These are the seditious Jews. And they are the locusts who are among the Jews, tormenting their own countrymen for the duration of the Lord. So they are the servants of Satan here. You have the Romans. They are the destructive force sent by God. And when Titus arrived at Jerusalem and saw the destruction and the squalid conditions within the walls, he offered them, Titus did, offered them conditions of surrender in hopes of saving the city. Doesn't do Rome any good to destroy the city of Jerusalem and the temple and everything there. And they wouldn't. They would not repent. And their wickedness and their evil apparently had come to a full measure. Look at what they're still doing. They did not repent of the work of their hands. They didn't stop worshiping demons and idols. They did not repent of their murders. They did not repent of their magic arts. They did not repent of their sexual immorality or of their thefts. So they continued listening to their false prophets. Is this slide 30? Okay. Slide 30, this is the Book of Wars, volume 6. It says they were the miserable people persuaded by these deceivers as such as belied God himself. While they did not attend nor give credit to the signs that were so evident and did so plainly foretell their future desolation, but like men infatuated without either eyes to see or minds to consider, they did not regard the denunciations that God made to them. Go back to, I think I have it on the slide, Luke, the next slide, Luke 21. verses 10 and 11. Then he said to them, nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be great earthquakes, famines, and pestilence in various places, and fearful events, and great signs from heaven. So God is trying to get them to repent. He's even bringing great signs from heaven. And Josephus mentions some of these signs during the festival season of 66 AD. So this would be prior to the time that Nero died and at the very beginning of this uprising that's going on. So sign one is the next slide, slide 32. I got to figure out why I have this black square on my...
Yeah, we can't figure it out. It's perfect back here
again. Okay.
So... But it's not perfect now.
Everyone right. So thus before the Jews' rebellion and before those commotions which preceded the war, when the people were come in great crowds to the Feast of Unleavened Bread, so that's the Passover, on the eighth day of the month of Xanthicus, which is a more modern word for Nisan, which is the year of the month of the Passover, and at the ninth hour of the night, so great a light shone around the altar and the holy house that it appeared to be bright daytime, which lasted for half an hour. This light seemed to be a good sign to the unskillful, but was so interpreted by the sacred scribes as to portend those events that followed immediately upon it. And so here's a great sign from heaven. This light that was there around the altar in the temple, so bright that it appeared to be daytime. And the scribes said, oh, this is a bad omen, not something good. The second sign is the next two slides. The eastern gate of the inner court of the temple, which was of brass and vastly heavy, had been with difficulty shut by 20 men and rested upon a basis armed with iron and had bolts fastened very deep into the firm floor, which was there made of one entire stone, was seen to be opened of its own accord about the sixth hour of the night. Those who had kept watch in the temple came hereupon running to the captain of the temple and told him of it, who then came up thither and not without great difficulty was able to shut the gate again. Next slide. This also appeared to the vulgar to be a very happy prodigy, as if God did thereby open them the gate of happiness. But the men of learning understood it, that the security of their holy house was dissolved of its own accord, and that the gate was open for the advantage of their enemies. So these publicly declared that the signal foreshadowed the desolation that was coming upon them. So here's another sign, as this huge gate just opened by itself. You can go over to Acts, the 12th chapter, and see when Peter escapes that the gates open by themselves. In fact, all the jail doors open by themselves as well. Listen, a similar thing happened. Look at next slide. When Jesus was on the cross, when he died, Matthew 21 says that at that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. Mark records the same thing. Luke records the same thing. It was now about noon, and darkness came over the whole land until 3 p.m, which is another great sign from heaven. For the sun stopped shining, and the curtain of the temple was torn in two. And Jesus called out with a loud voice, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. And when he said this, he breathed his last. And so these signs from heaven have been coming along. And here's another one. Listen, the veil of the temple was 24 feet wide and 80 feet tall in Herod's temple. You're not going to, and it was torn from the top down. Slide 36. Besides these, a few days after that feast on the 1 and 20th day of the month, Artemis, which is Jair. Listen, and I don't know if I give you this. This is the second Passover. You know, if people were unclean for the first Passover, then a month later they could do it the second time, and that's what this event is here. A certain prodigious and incredible phenomenon appeared. I suppose the account of it would seem to be a fable, were it not related by those that saw it, and were not the events that followed it of so considerable a nature as to deserve such signals. For before the sun setting, chariots and troops of soldiers in their armor were seen running about among the clouds of the surrounding cities. Remember Elisha's servant that saw the soldiers? And he said, the ones that are with us are more than with them. a similar thing there. And so let's go on to slide 37 for the fourth sign. Moreover, at the feast, which we call Pentecost, so we're 50 days later, or actually 20 days later from the other one, as the priests were going by night into the inner court of the temple, as their custom was to perform their sacred ministrations, they said that in the first place they felt a quaking and heard a great noise, and after that they heard the sound as of a great multitude saying, "Let us remove hence." And so the angels, and they're all leaving Jerusalem. Same year, sign 5, slide 38. Thus there was a star resembling a sword which stood over the city, and a comet that continued for a whole year. Now this is Josephus, and this is his recording. And now his conclusion in slide 39. Next slide. Keep going. For you could be no longer a place to fit for God. That was his conclusion, that Jerusalem, that was God's. He was telling the people, God can't stay among you. Why are you thinking that God is with you? He can't possibly stay among you. And then he said, for 4 years later, he wrote, "Wherefore I cannot but suppose that God has fled out of his sanctuary and stands on this side against all whom, again, on the side of those against whom you fight. Now even a man, if he be but a good man, will fly from an impure house and will hate those that are in it. And do you persuade yourselves that God will abide with you in your iniquities, who sees all secret things and hears what is kept most private?" Pretty impressive conclusion that he drew. And again, verse 21 just gives us the sins, the idolatries, the murder, the sorceries, the sexual immorality. The depth of their perversity and depravity was great. And we are out of time. I want to take just a little bit of time next Wednesday and talk about verse 21. That'll give us a conclusion of this sixth trumpet. We're again going to have an interlude like we had between the seals, which is in chapters 10 and 11, and then we're going to have at the end of chapter 11, we'll have the seventh trumpet finally sounding. It's amazing, and listen, that's, as in studying this, as I came to understand, this is about the destruction of Jerusalem and God's judgment on that whole system. It was never intended to last forever. His intention was to send his son and for a new covenant to be formed. But during these years, intervening years, from the time of Jesus' crucifixion until 70 AD, you had rival covenants. And God is finally going to show which one is his. And he's going to completely destroy the old and everything that had to do with it, so that they wouldn't be able to even worship anymore in that way. All right, so let's see. Next, 7 more days from that would be the 26th. If I don't write it on here, I won't know where to go. So I will not be sending out the notes for chapter 9 because I haven't finished them yet. So in chapter 8 will be plenty for you to pile through. So I'll send those out tomorrow, my notes, for those of you who ask for them. I don't just send them out to everybody. But I will be sending out the audio for this class in its entirety.